and we will see a resurgence in 10-year yields rising to over 10%, either by the end of this year or by the end of 2024, I'm sorry, or by the middle of 2025. And that will be enough to kill off a highly leveraged global financial system, which will result in what we call 7 years of rolling recessions or indeed depression.
Welcome back to Soar Financially, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us here for an exciting discussion. My name is Kai Hoffman. I'm the @JR Mining Guy on Twitter and the CEO of the Soar Financial Group. And the mantra of this channel is to discuss the macro to understand the micro better. And I believe that you will enjoy this discussion because I just had a chance to talk to Simon Hunt for the last 10 minutes before hitting the record button. And there's going to be a wealth of knowledge to be shared today as well. Simon is the most or second most viewed video here on our channel for a very good reason. I had a chance to re-watch and re-listen our video this morning as well. And his predictions were spot on in July. And it's time to recap the last 4 months and also try to give a bit of an outlook for 2024 and maybe 2025 as well, as there's so many trends in the world happening right now. I wrote down a whole list of topics we can discuss. We try to press as many or squeeze as many of them into a 45-minute discussion here, just to really come out ahead and understand the world. The world, actually. Let's try and understand the world and what is going on and how can we potentially profit from it as well. How do we position ourselves? How do we play these trends in the market? Before I switch over to my guest, real quick reminder, hit that subscribe button so we can bring guests like Simon on the channel more frequently. Now, without much further ado, Simon, it's fantastic to have you back on the program. Thanks so much for making the time.
My pleasure.
Absolutely. Simon, we have to have this discussion again. I think so much has changed the last 4 months. You were on July 30th. Let's start with a bit of a macro overview to our discussion. What has changed since the summer, and how confident are you in the economy these days?
I think very little has changed from what we were saying back in the middle of the year, which is that during the first quarter of next year, America and most of the rest of the world will be in recession. You have to ask the question, why did the Fed yesterday come out to be so dovish? The answer is very simple, that they are seeing what we've said will happen, that there will be a recession, and that the recession will start earlier than a lot of people have been saying. So what are the consequences of that? It means that the current rally that we are seeing in base metals and gold, well, let's say base metals, is probably premature. Demand continues to fall. Physical consumption continues to fall. If you look at copper, you would have thought that given the announcements of mine closures and cutbacks in production for next year, that the contango would narrow. It hasn't. It's widened, which means that the trade is saying there's plenty of physical copper around. So really what we're saying on the copper story is don't buy into this current rally, which will probably take us up to 88 odd hundred, because in the first quarter, we're going to see big falls. What we will see the middle of the year onwards will be the real cyclical rally where we will see a doubling in the price. So coming back to the macro situation, we will see probably either in March or April, certainly in that period, we will see the Fed being forced to pivot, not only because of recessionary trends, not only because that the White House wants to see a strong recovery for political reasons, but also because by then we are probably going to see an extension of the war between Israel and Hamas, going to a war between Israel and Hezbollah. There have already been skirmishes from both sides, but listening to Israeli television and very high level retired IDF and intelligence officers, the common enemy is Hezbollah as well as Hamas, and in addition, Iran. So I think the next step that we will see is a serious attack by Israel on Hezbollah. That is going to, again, this is another reason why the Fed will be forced into pivoting, cutting rates, and putting their feet firmly on the credit pedal.
I'm trying to, there are lots of different topics to cover there, Simon, and to really appreciate that introduction because it really was all-encompassing. I think let's start with geopolitics because it seems like there's a war on the trade routes happening right now. We've seen missiles being fired at oil tankers in the Strait of Hormuz in particular. Is that what you're hinting at? Is that what the Fed has to be paying attention to? Is that fuel to the recessionary fire?
Well, obviously, I don't know what the Fed is looking at, but the consequences of the war expanding over Israel and Gaza is very real. And there are two aspects that we need to look at, three aspects, really. The first is Israel mounting a serious attack on Hezbollah. Actually, that's probably what, though they won't tell you, what America wants to see happen. They want to open a second war front with Russia, because a serious attack in Syria will bring Russia in under their alliance treaty. Then, again, when you listen to what the Israelis are saying, the real enemy is not Hamas, is not Hezbollah, it's not Houthis, it's Iran. Now, if that happened, we would have a real regional, if not global, conflict. But that's a separate story. The other one, which I find very interesting, is the Houthis hitting the shipping in the Red Sea, which links into the Suez Canal. Should they actually sink a vessel and you close the Suez Canal down just at a time when the other big canal route, the Panama Canal, is having terrible problems because of drought conditions? By February, they will only have around a 50% capacity of ships being able to transit through the canal. And at the moment, there's a waiting list to get into the canal of 25 to 30 days. So vessels are having to be diverted around the Magellan Straits, which then adds at least a couple of weeks extra shipping time. So what this is also telling you is that shipping costs are rising, insurance costs are rising. So that's another impact that's going to have on the global economy. Now, the worst case, if the Suez Canal was shut down just at a time when the Panama Canal is having transit issues, we're going to have this renewed supply problem, which is going to bump up inflation even more than we're forecasting and cause all sorts of knock-on impacts.
Let's stay on the topic of Israel and the Middle East for now. Like, what is if you were to put a percentage on it, perhaps, Simon, of the situation spiraling out of control? You threw in, Israel's real intention is to do attack Iran, but the real enemy is Iran. That you mentioned, and if that were to spill over, what is the likelihood of China entering the war, given its relationships with Iran as well, and really turning this into a global disaster?
Well, first of all, I think we've got to take this step by step. The first step is obviously to obliterate Hamas. Assume they're successful, and I deliberately say assume they're successful. The second step is to basically kill off Hezbollah. There are all sorts of discussions taking place to push Hezbollah behind, I forget the name of the river, which is far enough so that normal tank missiles can't hit Israel. But those discussions, from what I piece together, are unlikely to succeed. So that means that Israel will be forced to mount a serious attack on Hezbollah. And Hezbollah exists both in Lebanon and Syria. So if there is a serious attack on Syria, that brings in Russia because of the treaty that they have between the two countries. The third step, and this is so the Hezbollah being attacked by Israel in a serious manner rather than a skirmish fashion, is a forecast. An attack, an aerial attack on Israel, is not a forecast, it's a risk. Because if that happens, then you don't just bring in Russia, you bring in China too. Do you want to go down that route? No.
No. I don't personally, to be honest. Because that spells disaster.
The consequences of that happen. The consequences, if that happens, are monumental.
Absolutely. I'm just looking at on Google News. I just typed in Israel and Hezbollah, and Jerusalem Post mentioned a diplomatic solution of moving Hezbollah away from the border is near. Like, what is the likelihood of that? And is that going to happen?
Low.
Diplomatic solution.
Who do you negotiate with in Lebanon? There's no government. Israel is not going to accept any verbal agreement. They're not going to accept the word of Lebanon. Even if somebody in the Lebanon signs on behalf of the Lebanese government, they won't accept it. You've got the 60 to 80,000 Israelis who've been relocated from the Galilee Heights. They're not going to come back unless there is something really firmly in place. Words are not going to be enough. So certainly, again, listening to the Israeli guys, the chances of a negotiated settlement with Hezbollah are pretty low.
I was just looking, like, how likely is the escalation of the conflict? I looked ahead of our conversation. I looked where the USS Eisenhower currently is. And it's just passed the Strait of Gibraltar, so it's coming in the Mediterranean. So I'm assuming Lebanon might be, or the coast of Lebanon or Israel there might be the potential destination here. Is that what could that mean as well? Do you want to put some context around that? Like the U.S. is that just sable rattling? Is it stabilization, de-escalation?
What you've got an aircraft fleet in the Sea of Oman. You've got an aircraft fleet together with America's most sophisticated command and control vessel, essentially off the coast of Israel. You've got a destroyer or two in the Red Sea. You've got about 45,000 troops in the Middle East. You still occupy parts of Syria, America does, and parts of Iraq. Both countries never invited America in. So why has America positioned such an enormous fleet of force? They say it's a deterrent, but to some people, it's an offensive weapon. So it's part of America's no longer using the real diplomatic route, where you had careful words and quiet discussions to find common cause, whereas America's way for decades has been brute force. But brute force seldom finds a solution without military action. So is this going to build into a bigger escalation? I don't know, but there's the risk.
I quickly want to dive into the motivation of starting a second front war with Russia and how that sort of fits in. Like, what's the US's motivation and intention there? And try to put that into perspective, because I think that's an important aspect of it all as well.
Well, I think from what I was picking up very early on is that the unstated policy of America was to encourage Israel to make a real attack on Syria, Hezbollah in Syria, which then brings Russia in, which then creates a second front to the war with Russia. And thus, if that happens, Russia is forced to bring forces in either from Russia itself or from Ukraine into Syria.
Let's discuss the Ukraine situation real quick as well, because it seems like, A, the media is not paying much attention anymore, and B, where is it ending? It seems like there's discussion about area, whether Ukraine sort of gives area and land to Russia, sort of, okay, we accept the new border to sort of put an end to all of this. Is that a likely outcome as well? Like, what is happening there currently in the Ukraine?
Well, people say there's a stalemate. There is no stalemate at all. Russia is in complete control and command and can do whatever it wants to do. A negotiated peace will only be on Russian terms. Is that likely? I find it difficult to assume, given the people who are in charge of foreign policy in Washington. How it's going to resolve itself, frankly, I don't know, except to say it will be on Russian terms. Whether those terms are acceptable to Washington, it may be acceptable to Kiev. Whether they'll be acceptable to Washington, completely different story. As you come back to the basics, which is that this war for Russia was really one of survival. If Russia lost the war in Ukraine, then NATO will be right on Russia's borders and be able to locate the most modern missiles on their border, on Russia's border, and therefore would create serious challenges to Russia's survival. From Russia's point of view, that is why the war in Ukraine is so important. So negotiated peace is going to be extremely difficult.
It seems like Zelensky's already pretty much putting a foot down and saying we won't accept any of these terms that Russia sort of put forward already.
Question then is, how long will Zelensky be there?
Seems like he's losing, like just reading the headlines, seems he's losing support even within the country.
Yeah.
So, interesting.
Basically, the bottom line is Russia is in the driving seat.
Simon, in our previous conversation, you mentioned about Russia, they might retaliate outside of Europe, getting back to the U.S. Like, what did you really mean by that? Because I didn't drill down on that remark, and I want to use that chance now since we're on that topic.
Well, what did I mean?
Personally, like based given the context of the conversation at the time.
I remember what I meant.
I was going to throw in the situation with Syria, potentially.
It actually goes back to the very early days of the war when NATO stroke Ukraine sank Russia's flagship in the Baltic. And it was done with American and Norwegian missiles. Russia knows it. So that was a personal blow to President Putin. And my comment then was, at some point, at some stage, he's going to retaliate. And retaliation could be either in Europe or somewhere else in the world. Somewhere else in the world could well be the Middle East. That's what I meant by that comment.
I think I threw in Sudan at the time as well. And we've seen a resurgence out there in Sudan. Also, Mali and Burkina Faso sort of comes to mind in that. You're the geopolitical expert, because I know Russia and the Wagner Group in particular, who we haven't heard much about in the recent months, but have been really active in those areas as well. That's where my mind went when you mentioned that, when you made that remark. Is that out of line, or does that fit sort of in there as well? Because it's completely off the map.
It's not big enough.
Yeah. Fair enough. It wouldn't make enough of a splash. you mean?
It wouldn't match the sinking of his flagship.
It wouldn't hurt the U.S. enough, or Western nations, NATO in particular.
Wouldn't hurt NATO enough, yeah.
Interesting. You keep bringing the U.S. back into this because they're the linchpin and everything. They're involved in all the sort of conflicts worldwide, unfortunately. And you mentioned as well that to save in a struggling economy, often one of the last straws economies and we call empires grasp at is war, brute force slash war. Right? Is that what we're seeing right now? Is this the last stage of an empire? Is that grasping at last straws right now?
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear we are seeing the last leg of an empire. It takes years for empires to fail. I mean, really what we have is a group of nations under the banner of BRICS who want to develop a system that is outside the dollar-denominated one, because they all have had bad experiences and they want to develop a multipolar world as opposed to the unilateral world that America has run and has dominated through military prowess and its currency being the sole reserve currency of the world. So if the BRICS is successful in the process first of de-dollarization and then of launching an alternative currency, which either directly or indirectly will be backed by gold, America won't want to see its hegemony being destroyed. So as in the fall of all empires, actually other than the British one, which was by diplomacy, it's likely to be a war. And I think the risk of a war by the early 2030s is very real.
We've talked de-dollarization a lot over the summer in particular, Simon, and we talked on that topic as well. It's really quiet down. Like the topic at that term, I haven't seen in mainstream media at all the last 3-4 months, really. But it sort of came back up to my mind when Argentinian elections happened and new President Milei said we were going to get rid of the peso and we're going to join the U.S. dollar and introduce the dollar as our new currency. Now Argentina also said, thank you for the invitation, but we won't be joining BRICS. Is Argentina a pawn in that in the U.S. dollar? Sorry, not in the U.S. dollar, but the U.S. versus BRICS battle?
My comment when I heard the president of Argentina saying we're going to go back to the dollar is you're going from the fat into the fire. Because on our work, you take the dollar index by 2030, the dollar index will have halved in value. So good luck to Argentina. The second point you have to say is it's very good to talk about the complete restructuring of Argentina. But is he going to be able to get it through the Argentinian parliament? I mean, he's on the easy phase at the moment. So let's wait and see and not jump to conclusions.
It's interesting. I've just been Googling a bit while we were talking as well. And Argentina's role, or Argentina in the emerging world order, is a topic by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. It seems like I need to dive deeper into this topic. It's really interesting because there's so much going on, like in that regard, right? It's really, really fascinating. It's like it's a polit thriller that is happening right in front of our eyes.
And,
absolutely fascinating, in my opinion. We talked a lot of topics, like you mentioned the Fed in your intro. We talked de-dollarization. You touched on commodities. I quickly want to talk bond market as well, because I think that could be interesting, because it's a little bit of fiscal warfare, if you want, is the U.S. Treasury market, because a lot of the debt is held outside of the U.S. as well. We need to touch on that. What's your opinion sort of on the bond market, especially Southern debt and a potential Southern debt crisis, meaning foreign nations dumping U.S. treasuries?
Well, I think the U.S. Treasury market is really the seat of all the problems, because it is treasuries are so widely held in and outside America and in such quantities. I think the Treasury market has been in trouble for some time. The first big problem was in March when you had the failure of some regional banks. I think that the bond market tells the real story. The equity market doesn't always. The long end of the bond market, 10-year treasuries plus, the Fed has very limited control. So it's the bond vigilantes who really run that market. And in America, forget the published CPI numbers and their derivatives. They're all mumbo jumbo. Because back in the 70s, when Arthur Burns was chairman of the Fed, he started playing around with the CPI numbers because he didn't want to raise rates. Most governments since then have manipulated the workings of the CPI. So there's a friend called John Williams who runs an outfit called Shadow Government Statistics that takes back CPI to the original workings, to where they should be today. And in round numbers, in September, October this year, the real CPI number is around 10%. Now, there's another outfit called the Chatwood Survey, which began life in 2017. And the Chatwood surveys 500 items twice a year in 50 different towns and cities. Same items every time. And they're items that households buy all the time. And in the first half of this year, their inflation number was 9.8%. And if you go back for the average since they were formed, started in 2017, it's 11.2%. So you can safely say the real inflation that households feel is around 10%, not 2, 3, 4, or 5%. So the bond vigilantes know this, and we will probably see early next year the US Treasury 10-year yield rising to over 5%. When the Fed pivots either late first quarter, early second quarter, then 10 years will fall again, but in the second half of the year, because the dollar will be falling, official inflation will be rising, the real inflation will be by mid-2025 be running at over 10%, and we will see a resurgence in 10-year yields rising to over 10%, either by the end of this year or by the middle of 2025. And that will be enough to kill off a highly leveraged global financial system, which will result in what we call 7 years of rolling recessions, or indeed depression.
I think, I've been reading a couple of comments under your recent interviews, and I think we need to clarify what a recession is versus a depression, and how it might differ real quick, Simon, since I have you. Because it seems like people expect a recession to be like a depression, where people jump out of windows and, pardon that, like saying that, but where it's really, really dire. Well,
that, right? Jumping out of windows is more akin to a depression.
Exactly. But I think a lot of people assume the recession is that, which recession is only depression. Like, not even that. Like, depression kicks in when GDP drops over 10%.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can have rolling recessions where you get global GDP falling by 3, 4, 5%, and then a short recovery, then another recession. Or depression is more like global GDP falls by 8, 10, 12%.
That massive difference.
But under both scenarios, you will have, trying to be diplomatic, you are going to have the biggest fall in equity and commodity markets starting by the end of 2025 and going through to probably 2030 that we would have seen since the Great Depression.
Absolutely. Simon, one last thing, like sort of to connect the geopolitics with the U.S. bond market and the debt situation as well, because based on what we discussed, it seems like things are spiraling a bit out of control in the Middle East. And if that happens, the U.S. will have to spend a lot on its defense budget, or keep spending, keep adding, blowing the deficit completely open, with and now taking in the yield, and exploding bond yields and interest rates. Is that the final nail in the coffin? Is that eventually,
because
it all seems like it's coming, like a big triangle, it's coming together.
It is. Absolutely right. And the triangle converges, in our view, by the middle of 2025. But you can easily advance it to the end of 2024 if we get an accident in the Middle East or elsewhere in the world.
I don't even want to think about that, to be honest. It's very dire. Like, it's a very sobering conversation, but I think one we desperately need to have because it's being widely ignored, in my opinion.
Let's try and soften how dire the situation becomes from mid 2025 onwards. Is that from the middle of next year, for the next 12 months, you're going to have a boom in commodities, a boom in equities. And if people are careful, you make money in that period to help you through the dire years. I mean, essentially, we have equities doubling in that period, in that 1 year. We have commodity prices doubling in that year. Oil over 150. Copper close to 14,000, but they fall first in the first quarter. So you wait for that correction in the first quarter and then don't stay on the dance floor and be the last guy on the floor.
That is some really good actionable advice, actually, to sort of maybe put a bow around our discussion here as well. Where are you putting your money right now, Simon?
I don't do anything.
Just sitting pretty?
Deliberately, because when I first started a consultancy, I was also writing about silver. And I then had a small, very small, long position in silver. And I realized that what I was writing was supporting my long position. So I do nothing. I leave it to other people. I don't want to know what they've done and what they're doing. So I can safely say what I say, I'm independent.
Simon, I just saw we have one last topic that I hadn't touched on. It can be a brief one, but it's the U.S. presidential elections next year. And
No comment.
will it even make a difference?
The first question you've got to ask, will there be an election? If you have a war, you have a sitting president. Yeah. The second question, if, for instance, and it's not a forecast, Trump was the GOP nominee and Trump won the election, Washington would probably not allow him to take the oath. So the third question is, do we have an independent who gets support from both parties, like Bobby Kennedy? Again, that is not a forecast. I think we've got, basically for me, simple me, there are those three scenarios.
Interesting. Do you see, based on that, a change in overall, let's say, foreign policy at all? Will that have an impact?
If the Democrats get in, no change, because the same people who run foreign policy will still be running foreign policy. If Trump did happen to make it, he has already sorted out, apparently, so I'm told, 5,000 odd people that he would immediately dismiss from State Department, the intelligence fraternity, blah, 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 and replace them with 5,000 people that he trusts. He's learned his lesson from his first term of office by people he had in the cabinet who were really part of the system. So if the Democrats get in, no change. If, for instance, Bobby Kennedy got in, again, not a forecast, but if he did, he would have a complete cleanup too. If somebody else from GOP got in, I question whether there'd be much of a change.
Interesting. Yeah, let's see how that plays out. Like the GOP races, we don't even know.
Hence I started by saying no comment.
No comment. Yeah, it's interesting, fantastic. Simon, I really, really appreciate your time. I always learn so much chatting with you. I hope our audience learned as much as well. Where can we find more of your insights, Simon?
Simon-Hunt www.sorafinancially.com.
No, you have a newsletter we can sign up for. I think I saw that as well.
Yeah.
I need to actually sign up for it because it's so insightful what you're putting out.
Oh, good.
I have your recent thoughts on gold actually in front of me here somewhere. I had it. There it is. Is it that one? You recently put out something on gold in particular, being a monetary anchor.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
some thoughts on that. So fantastic insights. We haven't had a chance to talk much gold today, but we'll do that next time we chat. And what is happening with the gold price as well. But I got to run. You got to run. We got stuff to do. Fantastic. Cheers. Simon, wonderful insights. Thank you so much. Everybody else.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely.
Bye.
Simon, thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
And
bye-bye.
Everybody else, thank you so much for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed this episode of SOAR Financially. A bit of a sobering discussion, to be honest, but I think it's one that we desperately need to have because there's so much going on in the world right now that we need to start to understand and make sense of, like who's motivated to do what and what could be the potential outcome. Simon has put some fantastic perspective around it. Yes, very sobering, but I think the clarity is needed, because especially if trade routes get shut down. What are the implications? We've seen that during COVID. What happens when there is a ship sideways in the Suez Canal? We've got a glimpse of that if that happens, right? So keep that in mind. There's so much hinging on that, and especially if you take in the U.S. economic situation, the debt crisis in the U.S., the bond market in the U.S., there's so much going on. It's tough to put a finger on a single, a single trigger for world chaos. Like, I hate to put it like that, but everything could trigger chaos in that regard. So keep that in mind. Make your, be positioned accordingly. Simon mentioned a few things towards the end of our discussion here, how you can sort of play out the scenario that we're in right now. Just don't be the last one on the dance floor, as he said. Keep that in mind. And subscribe to our channel for more fantastic, I wouldn't say advice, but information. Like, we don't want to give financial advice. We provide information so you can make up your own mind. It's extremely helpful having guests like Simon on. Ed Yardini was another one we had on earlier this week. Fantastic, insightful discussion. Bit of an optimist versus more Simon, more on the pessimistic side. But I think we need both sides of the spectrum to understand what is going on. So really appreciate you tuning in. Make sure to hit that subscribe button. Leave a comment, leave a like. And thanks so much for your time. Thank you so much.